This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Needs No Introduction presents the second in a series of three talks from the Social Change Institute Conference. The conference took place at the Hollyhock Retreat on Cortez Island in British Columbia in early May. This talk is by Van Jones. Van Jones is a 37-year-old founder and national executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He fights against human rights abuses in the U.S. criminal justice system, is an environmentalist, and a social entrepreneur. He's said to kick ass with compassion. And Judy Rebick says about Van Jones that he's got the potential to be as great a leader as Martin Luther King, if not greater. From the Hollyhock Retreat and the Social Change Institute Conference, Van Jones. And for the Rabble Podcast Network, I'm Wayne McPhail.
Well, I am just humbled to be here, and I'm so humbled to be here with you and you, Lil Ben. I wanted to say a couple of things before I get to my talk, which I hope I remember to do. You know, a lot of people ask why I do the work that I do. I work for alternatives to incarceration for urban youth. And I also work to heal the environment in urban America, especially in Oakland. And a lot of people get confused because it's like, why are you working on prisons and the environment? A lot of people don't see the connection. And I just want to say that, you know, for me, I don't believe we have any throwaway children. And I don't believe we have any throwaway neighborhoods. I don't think we have any throwaway species. I don't think we have any throwaway resources, continents. I think it's all precious. I think it's all sacred. And I think that increasingly that's where we should be doing our politics from. And that's what I'm about. And I want to talk about some of the hopes that I have and some of the things that I see that give me encouragement. First of all, everybody in this room, you're special people in a very difficult time. As hard as it seems right now, these are the good old days. These are the good old days. We are prior to the century-defining crises, right, that we know are coming. We're on this side of peak oil, still. We're on this side of the major ecological crises. We're on this side of the sort of house of credit cards that the U.S. economy is built on coming crashing down, and what that's going to mean politically, right? These are the good old days, okay? So you and I actually have an opportunity to proceed with a kind of cool-headed courage. We know what's coming, and there's still time. The one source of hope that I rely upon is because I actually do work in multiple communities. I get a chance to be in Hollyhock, I get a chance to be in prisons, I get a chance to be in, you know, rural America, I get a chance to be on both coasts. I see a wave of leadership that is beginning to emerge. I think you guys sense it as well. It's early, it's new, it's tender, it's not quite articulate, but it's emerging. And a lot of you in this room represent a good section, a good chunk of that wave. Many people in this room have known for a very long time that you are preparing yourself for something. Many of the people in this room, as long as you can remember, even when you were a little child, you knew that you were preparing yourself for something. And you've always been a little bit different. It hurt a little bit more when you saw the bullying. The madness in your home kept you up a little bit later than your siblings. That openness means that you spend a good part of your life stretching the muscle of your heart. It's like yoga. Stretching, you stretch, and at some point, your heart is big enough. We are at a place right now where there are thousands of hearts that are almost just about thin to be big enough. And your heart's one of them. What I want to suggest is that because of this new possibility that you represent, there's hope for the human family. It's a bold statement, but it's a statement I believe. Because of the yoga classes that you went to, because of the therapy you got, because of the campaigns you screwed up and survived, right, and learned from, and then saddled back up and came back around, because of the grants that you lost, and the staff you had to lay off, and the way it broke your heart and said, I'm never going to let that happen again. Because you went through all that, you're prepared for something. And there are some convergences that are beginning to happen now that will give you the opportunity and the possibility to do things that the average person reading the newspaper today would say it would be miraculous or impossible. What are they? I'm going to describe just three of them. They echo much of what's already been said at the conference. I'm just going to add my voice to the chorus. And then I want to talk about what does it mean for us that these convergences are beginning to happen. We got to, if things are converging, if old binaries are breaking down, if things are beginning to happen that haven't happened before, It would suggest that then some of the things that we used to do, we can't do no more. And there might be some new things we have to begin to do. So I want to describe the convergences, and I want to talk about the changes, the impact conceivably on our philanthropic model, on our fundamental strategic narrative, and on our seed or source mythology of who we even are. That might have to change. Right? Is that all right? So, no. It's already been covered in the conference, so I'm not going to belabor it. The main thing I came up here to say, I'm like, after the first day, I was like, well, my speech has already been given. But I'm going to give it anyway. I can't call it a whole new speech, so I'm going to give this part. And then I'm going to give my new stuff.
Would it stop you?
I don't know. It's fine. It used to be, where my friend Judy? It used to be Judy. That we operate inside these binaries, is what we were talking about. There used to be this either or. Either you were for social justice, save the people, or you were for ecology, save the planet. Right? And when you were in college or high school, you had to pick. Which group? What was your clique? Save the whales, save the Negroes. I don't know. Two different things. Social justice or ecology versus ecology. Right? It used to be that you were either for business or for activism. Right? You're either for doing well or for doing good. Business versus activism. Remember that?
Yeah.
And we were inside of that, and we dealt with that. And you had, you know, and you have your friends you went to college with or went to law school with, and some went, I'm going this way and I'm going that way. Remember that?
Yes.
And you called the names, didn't you? No. And it used to be that you had social change versus interchange. Remember that? Used to be either you're going to go out and fix the world, or you're going to go in a mountain, in a cave, a little babbling brook. Eagles soaring over. Remember that?
Yeah. And we used to live like this.
Like this was sane. Right? Like this made sense. But look what's happening now. Just again, look in this room. It's no longer social justice versus ecology. It's social justice and ecology. That V has become a plus sign. Social justice and ecology. Business and activism. Got the Ashoka people. We got the new term, the social enterprise.
Social entrepreneurs.
Got to make up stuff now. Because it's new.
New idea, new word.
I'm not mad. I'm just saying. And again, the people who, as I said to my friend Judy, the people who were secular, Marxist-Leninist, Trotskyist, in some contradictory but united front relationship with the anarchists and the anarcho-syndicalists, somewhat challenged by and yet willing to be in struggle with. And the left social democrats, and the left social democrats, all of those people who were in all of those meetings, all in therapy now. That didn't work. And if you go into any progressive bookstore now, go to San Francisco, go to Modern Times, that little Marxist section just getting small. And that self-help spirituality section. I'm just trying to be honest about what's happening. Because you can get confused if you just look at the theory of it. If you look at the practice of it, it's different. Same with our own people. They were own with the crystals. They had the whole thing. Incense. And they had the Indian stuff from continental India and Native American India. All the Indian stuff was covered anyway. Am I wrong? And George Bush just bombing everybody.
And the spiritual people had to say, hey, you know what? We have to put some feet up under these prayers. Put some feet under these prayers. And you've seen over the past few years of spiritual communities stepping out, speaking out, bringing into social struggles new tools, new methodologies, new insights, that the social change versus interchange is now a blessing. And that's who you are. And what I want to suggest is that the next big movement, the next hopeful upsurge, is going to come from the richness of those plus signs interacting with each other, which is who you are, which is what you're doing. And it is that fertile set of contradictions. And we're entering an era of paradox and contradiction. And people who are, as we said earlier, who are comfortable in that, have such a tremendous advantage and gift. In other words, you. Out of that fertile ground, something new can be born. And that something new can save the planet. If it were super easy, we could just relax a moment, but don't. Because some things have to begin to then change in light of this that can be hard to change. I want to talk about a few of them. First of all, our folks, to the extent that some of this work is going to be done by NGOs, not-for-profits, etc., has to be in some relationship with donors, foundations, etc. In other words, to the extent that some of the practical work going forward is going to engage and involve philanthropy, something got to change. Something has got to change. Because the present model of philanthropy has, as an inevitable outcome of its present functioning and model, one awful, horrible, despicable consequence, and that is that it makes me and you into liars. We lie. I run a not-for-profit. We lie. We lie to our donors. We lie to our foundation, program office. And they desperately want us to. What do we say? We have a problem. There's a solution. We are the best people to implement the solution. If you fund us, we'll give you deliverables and outcomes. There's a problem. There's a solution. We're the best people in the solution. If you fund us, we'll give you deliverables and outcomes. This is a lie. What's the truth? We don't know. We don't know what to do. We don't know what the solution is. We don't know what the answer is. We absolutely do not know. But we are terrified and afraid to say that. So what does that mean? That means that the relationship between the donor and the not-for-profit leader becomes like a relationship between a parent and a teenager. The parent doesn't actually want to know. Am I wrong? And so the donor community
willfully pretends that it believes our BS. Now, if you look at all of our websites, you look at all of our newsletters, you look at all of our reports, and you read them all, you would have to conclude that we live in a socialist utopia. All of our reports, all of our websites, we are marching from success to success. Victory to victory. Achieving goal after goal. This is delusional. And then they would say, oh, well, I'm so happy to hear this. Check. Now, what's the impact? What's the impact? We're lying to ourselves. We're lying to each other. We're in this dysfunctional relationship. And no honest reporting is going on. So we can't learn anything together. Why was it so awkward for poor Todd and so Moses' wife? For them to have to be sitting here on the hot seat, lukewarm seat, breathe the cold seat. Because we don't talk like that. We don't even know about each other's work. Have you heard about so-and-so? Oh, yes. They do amazing work. You're amazing.
Oh my God.
What do any of us do? No one knows. We're afraid to ask. It's because we're afraid to tell. This is the now. Am I wrong?
You're wrecking speed dating for tomorrow.
But the impact is, we aren't learning. We aren't sharing. And this is the wrong time in history for us to be lying to each other. The philanthropic model has to change. We've got to be honest with each other, because the stakes are too high. Rather than falsely promising outcomes and deliverables, and then ginning up the story, trying to kind of polish the turd. Got too far? Yeah. I'll take that. Anyway. Abusing the fertilizer. Rather than doing that, why don't we just change it? Why don't we say, you know what? Here's the truth. We don't know. We're dealing in a world of new situations, ignorance about what will work and what won't work. We're not funding outcomes, we're funding experiments and honest reporting. We're funding experiments and honest reporting. And so we aren't even necessarily looking for the biggest expert, but the person with the most integrity. That becomes the new highly sought after leadership quality. Can you tell the truth even when it's painful? Philanthropic model's got to change. Strategic narrative. Our strategic narrative also no longer serves the whole of what we're trying to pull together. What is the central myth? The central mythic narrative that underlies the left? You ever had to think about that? If you were doing a movie, if you were like, well, how does the left story of itself work? Very simple. David versus Goliath. Isn't that what we do? We're the little, righteous, absolutely pure. Defenders of all good, going up against hopeless odds. There's courage, the determination, willing to speak our truth to power, confronting a holy evil, a massive, powerful enemy that we will overcome. And that is actually a very good story. It's good. I'm not saying it's bad. It's good. Courage. Belief in miraculous outcomes. Willing to take on tough challenges. Right? But there is a shadow side. And we're not honest about the shadow side. The shadow side is there's got to be some big other we're mad at. Even if it's in our own coalition. Somebody's got to be right. Somebody's got to be wrong. How are we going to deal with it? Confrontation. Politics of confrontation. And it's eating our organizations alive. It's eating our coalitions alive. It's eating our relationships alive. Because it's very hard to know when that's the appropriate story to tell. I would argue, given what we know is coming, given the trailer for Al Gore's movie. Anybody see that?
Yes.
You saw the movie?
Yeah.
You just, you just like, yeah. We might want to look at another part of that book. Rather than doing David and Goliath all the time, it might be time for Mr. and Mrs. Noah. Very different story. Very different story. Mr. and Mrs. Noah. Huge crisis. Not just some big asshole like George Bush. George Bush could leave the planet today, and you got a problem still.
Bigger.
Hmm?
Bigger problem.
Bigger problem. Major problem. Global warming, peak oil, ecological crisis, species extinction, completely destabilized. We have a major, major crisis coming. And the slingshot ain't gonna do much for it. In order to survive, we've gotta declare all of life precious. In order to survive, we've gotta begin to prepare now. My sister was doing the food security. Yeah. In order to survive, am I right? We've got to start preparing to yesterday, right? To build an ark. And we're going to have to manage diversity on a scale and a level we've never even imagined. That's what Noah and his family go. That might be the salvation myth. And then, unlike the old myth, where you have to figure out how you're going to win against and win against and win against. You have to figure out how we're going to win over an awful lot of people, as you said yesterday. We have to win over a lot of people. Different leadership challenge. Okay? I'm going to give you a practical example of what that might look like. And then I'm going to just tell you a story about one of my heroes, and then I'll be done, all right? What would a Noah myth give us? If we were operating from a Noah myth, what would that give us? Let's take the ecological crisis. I'm going to tell you a story about the ecological crisis using the Noah myth that might point a way out for us strategically. Tell me how I do. We are entering the third wave of environmentalism. We are entering the third wave of environmentalism. The first wave was a conservation wave. Teddy Roosevelt, you know, the whole, you know, let's not pave all of it, right? Can we keep a tree just to show Junior? Conservation. And that shone ahead its day. And then Rachel Carson, Silent Spring 1963 comes out. Right? Suddenly, we realize this is not just about the critters and the creeks. This is about us. It's about human health effects. This is about poison in our own bodies. And you inaugurate a new wave, second wave of environmentalism. Conservation plus regulation. There was a problem in the second wave. For a while, white polluters and white environmentalists appeared to be conspiring to just push all the poison onto poor brown people. So you had to have a boom inside of that called environmental justice that said, no. Conservation, yes, plus regulation with equity. You can't, don't regulate all over here on my shoulder. Okay? Let's do it fairly. But that was still this beautiful moment. Conservation plus regulation with equity, second wave. We're now entering the third wave of environmentalism. And that third wave of environmentalism is conservation plus regulating the problem plus investing in the solution. Plus investing in the solution, investing in solar, investing in wind, investing in permaculture, investing in organic agriculture, investing in high-performance buildings, investing in new, clean, and green technology. Green tech went from $324 million invested in 2004, estimated now to be, in 2009, $1 billion plus. Bill Gates putting his money on the table, Steve Case putting his money on the table, green tech is about to take off. A massive investment in trying to pull off an ecological U-turn based on investing in the solutions. Third wave of environmentalism. Conservation plus regulation of the problem plus investment in the solution. Why is that so important? Because this new green wave of technology, this new green wave of opportunity, lends itself to a question. And it's the answer to this question that will give us the way out collectively. Will the green wave lift all boats? Will this new green wave lift all boats? Or will we have eco-apartheid? We have some communities with solar this and bio that and organic the other, and other communities like Oakland with cancer clusters and pollution pockets and kids with asthma. Or we have eco-equity. If we make a decision as a movement to say, no, we have to rescue life on this planet, and we have to do it collectively. We have to build an ark that we can put the failing communities on. You begin to have a new politics. It's a politics of real solidarity. It's a politics that says the only way for these new environmental solutions to work is if the majority of people can embrace them. It's a massive ecological and sociological U-turn, and we have to work together to do it. Suddenly, the young people who don't have any jobs have a reason to talk to the environmentalists. Why? Because you can offer them jobs, putting up the solar panels. Retrofitting the buildings. There's jobs and opportunity you can offer to young urban youth who right now don't care about environmentalism. But you're now saying to them, we want you to have a job. And your job will be dignified work that can help save the planet. By making the declaration that those communities that were locked out of the last century's pollution-based economy, those neighborhoods that were locked out of the last century's pollution-based economy, will be locked into the new clean and green economy. We now have a positive, proactive basis to build a real coalition, a real solidarity that addresses economic challenges, environmental challenges, ecological challenges, and spiritual challenges. That's what a Noah myth will do. Now notice, there's nobody to beat up. Some bad guy will show up and beat him up later. But in the actual articulation, there's no enemy required. It's a very different way of doing politics. It'll drive some people nuts. Where do I get to beat up George Bush? Will be the first question. Don't worry, he'll show up. But the fundamental commitment is that the Green Wave will lift all boats, that we're going to build an arc, and we're going to pose up clear for the public. And I'll close with this, because I am. We're going to pose up clear for the public that the sink or swim politics that we saw the Bush administration guilty of during Katrina, the sink or swim politics that we saw the Bush administration guilty of with Katrina, is one path the human family can go down. And we are standing for a different path. We are the stewards of the people who are shaping out and nurturing and holding and believing in a different path, a Green New Deal, a new partnership for business, for government, for labor, for community, for youth, that will let the human family survive and that will let us preserve the best of what's left here on this planet. And that's who we are, you see. We are those people. We are those people who are holding open that opportunity. Now, is that left, is that right? I don't know. And most people don't care. They need to understand what we stand for. So in closing, I want to say this. I don't know, actually, what the new leaders of the new century will do. I don't know what their tactics will be, I don't know what our strategies will be. I don't know what our organizational form will be. I don't know what our management rules will be. I don't know what our HR guide will look like. I don't know what our, none of that. I don't know what we will do. I do know who the leaders of the new century will be. It will be those people who have been willing to confront seriously the warmongers without and the warmongers within. The warmongers without and the warmongers within. The punitive, judgmental incarcerators without and the punitive, judgmental incarcerators within. The polluters without and the polluters within. The greedy, self-interested, capitalist developers without and the greedy, self-interested, capitalist developer within. That's who it will be. And I offer to you that at the end of the day, it is probably going to be the case that for the next 5 to 10 years, as we make our way through this new period of contradiction, paradox, and confusion, it is more important to us, will be more important to the community, and will be more important in the eyes of history, who it is we choose to be. Thank you very much.
Oh, Jeez. You know, California locks up more kids than anybody in the world. And we've got 3,200 children in some of the worst prisons you could imagine in California. 24 months ago, there were 5,120. We've been waging this relentless campaign, and we pulled those numbers down by about 25%. And the way that we did it was we talked to the moms, and we talked to the dads, we talked to the grandmas with a little video camera about this big. And we talked to some of the kids when they came out, and we made a little film. And we took that little film, little DVD, to 20 out of our 54 counties. And we showed it to probation officers and judges, and they were shocked to hear about the rapes, to hear about the brutality, to hear about the incredible, we've had 4 deaths in our youth prison system in the past 2 years. In Louisiana since 1978, they've had 1 death in their whole system. Mm-hmm. Shows you how brutal and violent our system is. And we went to Sacramento and we fought and they told us to go to hell and blah, blah, blah. But the power of this film and the power of these young people and the power of these moms, these parents telling the truth about what's happening to their kids has actually convinced judges and that they're just not going to send kids to the state prison system. Where they're sending them instead is to local programs where they're close to home. And what I think is so important about that work is that Julia Butterfly Hill, who's one of my dear friends, and we kind of represent this kind of new axis or whatever in Northern California. She created something called Environmentalists for Books, Not Bars. And you know, it used to be we would go to Sacramento with our parents, and we'd have the T-shirts on, clothes, CYA prisons, and legislative aides would laugh at us. It was, black and Latino, mostly grandmas walking down the hall, getting laughed at by legislative aides. That'll never happen. Here come the hug a thug people. I just have fun with them. You would be amazed at how the response changed when we started coming down those halls with leading environmental activists from across California who were standing with us and who were using their legislative access to get meetings for us that we couldn't get for ourselves. And it strengthened their work. It strengthened their work. It deepened their commitment. It expanded their understanding of what it means to stand in reverence for something sacred that people are discounting. It deepened their work. And so there is a politics of solidarity and possibility that's available to all of us, and we're showing that with our prison work. So thank you for asking me. Okay, I see 2 guys' hands. I'm getting troubled by calling y'all, so work with me. Some women, somebody. Some women somewhere, gotta have a question. You, and then I'll come back. We'll make it 5 instead of 2.
So I really appreciated your watch, which is the whole thing. About the changing the field, I do think it turns us into liars. I mean, we have chosen as an organization not to engage in that, but then only 10% of our budget comes from grantors because we don't have enough deliverables to fill up all those grant applications. But I'm curious, and I'd like to know, if I was the grantor, what have you failed at? What do you feel? What have you failed at? What is?
Oh, geez. I mean, I get all these awards and shit. I'm an Ashoka Fellow and mm-hmm. all kind of stuff. There are more people in prison now than when I started. Okay? Mm-hmm. There are more prisons now than when I started. Mm-hmm. So it's farcical. It's silly. I mean, I'd be happy to have an award, but, at a certain point, it doesn't make sense to me to
come in my office and see all these awards telling me what a great person I am and how incredibly effective we are. And we've done some things, and I'm proud of things that we've done. We stopped this, but it hurts because I'm on the second floor of my building, and the first floor, people down there crying. Can you help me? Can you get my baby out? And I can't. So that's real. And no, and we're afraid to say that to each other. We're afraid to say, I won this campaign, and I'm glad I won this campaign, but the rest of the damn continent is paved. And just be real about it. And shed some tears about it, or be mad about it, or laugh about it. But you know what I mean? And so what I'm saying is that we set up these little hamster wheels, and we give ourselves all this credit for running faster and faster inside of them. And it's the wrong time in history for that. Yes. Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I think one of the reasons that we wind up doing that is because people are competing for funding.
Yes.
So there's a competition system that's underway. What do you see in the convergence of issues and understanding of fundamental synergies between issues? How do you see that playing out in terms of decreasing competition and increasing the efficacy of funding?
I just don't know. I just don't know. My suspicion is that there's a way to be in this work where the dollars matter a little bit less. That's my guess. Dr. King wasn't a great fundraiser, turns out. But there's a way that he was in the work that meant that what he was able to do was bigger than the dollars. And I've said it a lot of times, and I'll keep saying it. We keep trying to do this work the way we've been doing it. Dr. Martin Luther King did not get famous giving the speech called, I have a complaint. I have a very long list of stuff I'm pissed off about. It's a very, very upsetting statistics. I think are jerks. That wasn't a speech. And at some point, we've got to get back to saying, you know what? I may not get the grant. I mean, the song you sang. I mean, they might put me in jail. They might come with guns and knives, but I'm gonna keep telling the truth anyway. At some point, we gotta get back to that. I'm a long way from that. I stay up and I worry about my 22 staff members and their kids and that kind of stuff, and I start, hey, well, let me make this, I ain't gonna lie, but I'm sure going foreground the good part. Weakens me as a leader. Mm-hmm. It's weakening all of us. We gotta figure that part out. Here.
So speaking of figuring that part out, I want to just what for me resonates is you're talking about how all of these issues are really just one big issue, right? So poverty, social justice, and the environment. And aside from the example of your own work, I mean, how do you see, if my perception that there are, I agree that there are these deep disconnects, but that they're becoming plus signs.
Yeah.
But, and I think we can all agree that needs to happen, it needs to happen more and faster and soon, yesterday. But the question is, so how exactly do we do that? Because there are still these very, very separate movements, categories, sort of gaps.
It's three basic adjustments at the end of the day. One, it's stop working on issues and start working for solutions. Now that seems real technical, like I'm just playing with words.
Yeah.
Ask somebody on the left
what issue they work on. And they will talk without taking a breath for about 25 minutes. They will tell you the problems, the statistics, the whole deal. They'll have their anecdotes. Ask them, LF, what issue you work on. And you will not be able to shut them up. Ask them, LF, what solution are you working for? Crickets? Because that's not how we talk. The thing is, when you have an issue-based movement, issue doesn't work for problem. So you have a problem-based movement, right? And guess what? You got a movement with a lot of issues. That's what we have. A problem-based movement with a lot of issues. What I would suggest is that we need a solution-based movement. So the good thing about that is once you actually identify a solution, like our friend Mary, it suddenly becomes very clear you need a whole lot of friends and very few enemies to get your solution put through. And that's the shift. Once we know what it is we're fighting for, Julia, my sister, always says, we have become so good at defining what we're against that what we are against is now defining us. We're anti-war, anti-sexist, anti-racist, anti-everything. And then wonder why nobody wants to come to our party. Be my friend. I hate everything. So one, we got to switch to solutions. Issues to solution. One shift. Second shift. We've got to expand our heart. This is not a head thing. This is a heart thing. When you say the green wave will lift all boats, we're not going to have eco-apocalypse. We're not just going to go over the cliff. And we're not going to have eco-apartheid either. The green wave will lift all boats. How do you do that? I don't know. No idea. We're doing some little things in Oklahoma, but I have no idea. But just to declare that, right? That you're not going to leave anybody behind. You're not George Bush. It's not Katrina. You would not leave people behind. And we got to talk like we would so people don't imagine that you only care about your thing and don't care about me and my children. Okay. Third thing is, we need a politics around this. Again, we need a politics around this. I'm happy for some different consumer choices. All for it. But the government is on the side of the problem makers in the economy. The government is on the side of the warmongers. The government's on the side of the polluters. The government's on the side of the clear cutters. The government's on the side of the despoilers. And we need a politics that says we want the government on the side of the problem solvers in the economy, not the problem makers. We want the government on the side of the art teachers and the coaches and the counselors and the little people trying to make the solar industry work. And that whole, they're beautiful people with pennies that are doing more to solve the problem than these people with billions of dollars in subsidies that are making the problem worse. We need a politics that says we don't want a welfare state, fine, but we don't want a warfare state either. We don't want a warfare state either. We want government as a partner to the people who are trying to solve the problems. That is the third piece. Issues to solutions. Me, my, listen to me. To we need a politics for everybody. And we want the government, and that's when it gets dangerous. Mm-hmm. We want the government on the side of this. And once you start talking like that, you know, in the United States, you know, I'm talking about red states and blue states. I'm a Christian. I'm from Tennessee, born and raised on the edge of a small town, so-called red state. I can go anywhere in the United States and talk. Because I'm not telling you how stupid you are. And I'm not telling you how wrong you are for your faith or for who you voted for last time. I voted for Leonard Peltier last time. So people can be mad at me. What I'm saying is
whenever I go anywhere, I know you love your country. And some of us still believe in liberty and justice for all. Some of us still believe in America the Beautiful. Why can't we work together on that? And there's a place that we can stand where we can go back to those same communities and those same families and those same neighborhoods where we got hurt so bad as kids, we got hurt so bad as teenagers, and we ran away. And we created our own little thing and our own little clique and, you know, got our own little piercings, our own little thing. We can't let high school and hurt from high school kill the planet. At a certain point, we have to get ourselves back together and go back home. It's not when, how do we speak to ordinary people? How do we speak to ordinary Canadians? How do we speak to ordinary Canadians? How do we speak to ordinary Americans? What happened that we decided to forget how to speak to our cousins? What happened that we decided to forget how to speak? And can we go back to that hurt? And can we go back to that pain? And can we go back and look at it and say, you know what? I'm a big person now. Patrick Carmody and Danny Davis. I'm probably bigger than them now. All the bullies, all the big clique people, all the cheerleaders who look like me. I can probably get over that now. Let it go. Last question.
Do you mind if I go here?
We know each other, so
you basically just said what I was going to bring up. So
okay. That, and I can abuse you because we know each other. So, last question.
How do you take care of yourself?
Poorly. But thank you for asking.